That's how Matthew was.
Yeah, either way, it should be fine with sharing. And you hit the record. Well. Okay, let's just double check. Did you, you're definitely recording from this device too. I'm sorry.
Phone's recording, so yeah, we're good.
Okay, good. Awesome.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Ooh, that was a nail biter.
But you're definitely not recording that.
I am.
You are.
So I, your other one was stopped.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's.
Sorry,
no, no.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I am duly recording. We're recording over there and here, just to for redundancy. That computer. Yeah. Me neither. I just found out.
I'm not sure yet what the ultimate recording looks like, right?
It'll upload it after, and then I'll put it on the website.
Two cameras recording. That is
should be this, because that it's like
your face and the
exactly what you see up there. Yeah. Okay.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you need anything for that?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
We'll be right here.
So just in an attempt to be high tech, I did not put a paper and pencil sign in. So if you can please hit the QR code, and then you can just leave your name and your email, that would be great. Sorry to cut your conversation off.
And the QR code, in case you don't know, is on the back table there.
It should work from this screen too.
Yes, but if they wanted to get it on the website.
Yeah.
That never works for me at a restaurant, but that works.
All right.
Are you saying we're better than a restaurant? Is that what you say?
I think it's the Wi-Fi.
Mine either. I can never get it.
That's pretty cool.
I'm glad it worked.
Yeah.
Now, does it work off? Can you do it off of the projector? That's the real test.
Andy, sign in with the QR code at the table. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Too late for that now.
Yeah, right? Yeah, his face is all over the website.
Teacher postings.
Yes.
27th. Might need to push that out.
I don't know.
I haven't seen much. I get the emails, and my tally is small. Yeah, me too. All right, I'm going to get started. Welcome, everyone. So I am recording this, but so don't say anything really loud or embarrassing because you're being recorded. And then we're going to push this out so that we can kind of reach as many people as possible. The purpose of this presentation is just to provide the community with an update on the summary to the special education plan. This plan is due to the state every 3 years. Due to COVID, it was actually delayed not once, but twice. So it was delayed 1 year, and then it was delayed sort of like a quarter of a year, which kind of means on the back end, when we're done this process, we have about 1.75 years before we start it again. So just food for thought. So as always, we're going to, let me see if I can click through my slides, begin our presentation with our mission and vision. The Department of Student Services and our obligation is of vital importance and very much in alignment with this mission and vision. I'm gonna try to also move this so you can see it best I can. So I want to draw your attention to this because it resonated with people, particularly community members at one of our meetings. We shared these belief statements, which are actually found on our website. And in a feedback session in March, these really people spent some time talking about these because I guess they really resonated. And the underlining is mine, but I'm just going to give a minute for you to read through them because I really think these get at the heart of our mission, our vision, and our work in student services and why we kind of come to this work at all. Okay, so as part of the process, we've had several meetings. Pennsylvania Department of Education asks school districts to form a committee that includes at least one parent, as well as district personnel, as a means for informing the process of developing the special education plan. From the onset, Dr. Marseille had really asked our department to ensure that this was an inclusive process and that numerous voices were heard, including those offering some critical feedback. So it was our intention to do this with to provide a voice to not only special education teachers, but to ensure that they were representative for elementary, middle, and high school administration. Some of our administrators are here tonight. Parents of students with various disabilities across the schools, including those who don't attend our schools. So these sessions were targeted in that our department reached out to specific individuals who met these criteria. Just to summarize, on February 22nd at 1 p.m., the process began with a small group of stakeholders. On March 2nd at 6 p.m., the contents of the data presented in this meeting were presented to the Educational Affairs Committee, which was open to the public. On March 22nd at 6 p.m., a targeted group of parents representing students at all levels and participating in various special education programs provided feedback to our office. On April 19th, a targeted group of staff provided feedback. On April 29th, our administrative team met with a small group of parents who are in the process of formalizing a new parent group, which I'm going to actually return to shortly. Their feedback was also incorporated. This afternoon's meeting was open to all. We are recording it we got feedback and we our aim is to record it and post this recorded presentation to our website under the newly revised section of the website dedicated to the special education plan. I just want to note that I co-chair the policy committee also. The Office of Student Services is very busy streamlining and bringing all the policies that affect and protect students with disabilities into kind of the 21st century, if you will. The policy committee is held on the last Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. and is also open to the public. Tomorrow's meeting for policy, that is going to entail a second reading of policy 218 relating to student discipline, as well as first reads for multiple discipline related policies, as well as a new proposed policy concerning electronic devices. So I'm just kind of giving a plug for some of how I moonlight in this district, right? Some of my other responsibilities. So I just want to give an example of what that looks like too and why policy is important for special education. Students with disabilities must be considered differently in the event of a disciplinary infraction that would otherwise result in the removal from the educational environment. Electronic devices, for instance, which might be otherwise prohibited under a prospective policy, doesn't exist yet. We would make allowances for students, I hope this is obvious, for students who require technology to communicate, which some of our students do. So those are reasons why Student Services is very invested in making sure that our policies are consistent with the protections of IDEA. So at our session so far, we've presented data that's informed our thinking, particularly concerning the district's challenges related to the provision of special education through this sort of simple lens of an overview, where we've been, where we're headed. We're going to follow that this afternoon. For those of you new to this conversation, we're just going to begin with an overview. To that end, this slide's title is probably a misnomer. This list contains programs that the Office of Student Services oversees. What is it, though, that our office actually does is probably a more appropriate question. In short, and this is my definition, Student Services does or should offer programming for students whose needs are just not being met in the absence of that programming. So this presentation concerns special education under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. But we also do oversee the legal accommodations required under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or Chapter 504 of the Pennsylvania School Code. We ensure the accurate identification of gifted students under Chapter 16 of the Pennsylvania School Code. We provide counseling services to all students, regardless of whether they are disabled. We implement related services such as speech, occupational, and physical therapy. We ensure that a continuum of critical nursing services are provided and that school psychologists have the tools necessary to meaningfully identify students in a timely manner, also known as child find. That's our child find obligation. I want to pause right now and just say that I'm one of the newer members of this team to this district. This work's really, really important. What we do is also really broad in scope. We would not be able to do any of this work were it not for the outstanding people, some of whom are here today, but in the office within which I work. My onboarding this last year would have certainly not been a success at all were it not for some of the outstanding individuals in this office. So I just want to go through them. I'm Ian Sandberg. I probably should have led with that. I'm one of the directors of Student Services. So I'm focusing more on the special ed side of things. I'm going to go down and just introduce some of my colleagues, not necessarily in the order of this slide. I'm joined by Ms. Jean Selecki. She is a supervisor of elementary special education. Dr. Megan McCullough, director of student services. She's focusing on the behavioral health side. And then we also have at the very end there, not here, but in our office, if you were to call, you would speak to Jody LaRose or Brian Leopold, who do a phenomenal job. And much of the work that we do, I'd say 99% of it is not this. It's not presenting. It's the legwork and the heavy lifting that these folks do. I also want to note that we have new people. So if you were at our legislative meeting last night, two individuals listed up here were appointed as new administrators. So Christina Lewis is a supervisor, will be a supervisor of elementary special education, supervisor of secondary special education in July. Sorry, I got that wrong.
Give me a heart attack.
Yeah, you're being switched. Sorry. We're going to talk a little bit about communication. So that was not, please don't see that as a harbinger for how our communications run. Leslie Schaud is also going to be joining us for as a supervisor of counseling and wellness. Did I get that title?
I did.
All right.
Yep.
So we are certainly lucky to have these new individuals. But again, with respect to institutional memory here, we are very lucky to have the folks we have already here. Okay, so as we drill down just a little bit on the data related to our programs, I just want to draw to your attention the fact that, again, we do a lot in our office. It would be difficult for any student, in fact, in this district to move through this district without having either benefited from the work of student services or specific to our work here today, required it under the law in order to receive a free and appropriate public education, or FAPE. Okay, we'll move on. So just in terms of looking at a decade's worth of data, this is important. The district's enrollment and our special education numbers are relatively static. On one hand, this is good news because it allows us some predictability in terms of our programming. We are not a district that has massive population influx and outflux as well. So it's good from that perspective. So we're not also host to any facilities under 1306. Of the Pennsylvania School Code, whereby we'd be obligated to provide special education services to students who, if they were hospitalized, or if we had a juvenile detention center, those kinds of things. So that also allows for some predictability in our numbers. On the other hand, because of our relative small size, a small influx of students does actually kind of alter our numbers pretty quickly. So you can see, you know, I think if you were comparing us to a district like the School District of Philadelphia or a Central Bucks that has 17,000 some students, you know, you probably would be less likely to see a 4% difference like you see in that sort of last column in the far bottom right there. That being said, all things told, we are a relatively static district numbers wise. The breakdown of the numbers is mostly aligned with the breakdown of the state. So as is typical, the majority of students eligible for special education fall under the category of specific learning disability, or SLD, which is about half of our students. Under IDEA, just bear in mind, there are 13 different disability categories. Students can qualify for special education under multiple disability categories. So in an attempt to not muddy the waters here, these numbers are only the primary identification. A primary disability category of other health impairment makes up a little less than 1/4 of our students with disabilities. And what we refer to as low incidence disabilities sort of kind of fill out the rest. Autism at 13%, emotional disturbance 6.9%, intellectual disabilities in students with hearing impairments make up, you know, 3% or so. Just note that we have 34 students who participate in we're a host to IU programming for the deaf and hard of hearing. They're not, those 34 students who are not residents are not kind of, they're not included in sort of this breakdown, just to be clear. Okay. The district is currently invested in an equity audit, if you haven't heard. So we are attempting to recognize and address the systemic barriers that prevent all students from having meaningful access to success. This is especially true in the identification of students with disabilities. So I just want to draw your attention to those first two lines there. I think that's reddish pink. Whereas 7.1% of the district students are Black or African American, double that percentage makes up our special education population. Meaning that Black and African American students are disproportionately overrepresented in special education, double. On one hand, the district has a child find obligation, right? We mentioned this before. We have a legal requirement to identify students with disabilities in a timely manner. On the other hand, there is a lot of reasons to scratch our heads here and believe that special education identification, even if legally required, is providing a reactive remedy to a systemic problem that is well underway long before a student is evaluated. Along these lines, 9% of the district students are Asian, and yet 4.2% of students receiving special education are Asian, meaning that Asian students are disproportionately under-identified for special education. White students are identified for special education slightly below their proportion of the population, and Hispanic students are slightly overrepresented. Those two categories are a lot more in alignment than are Black, African-American students and Asian students. We started the presentation off saying that our office is critical to the mission and the vision of the district. As the district continues to pour through its work and its findings from the equity audit, our office in particular has to ask the prevailing question, for which students is the current system benefiting and why? I'm going to return to that. So when I came on board this past September, the district's office was in the middle of cyclical monitoring. We're technically not yet out of that, I should note, but as well as engaging in the early stages of the special education plan. Going into the plan, we already were aware of needs. Coupled with the findings of cyclical monitoring, as well as other publicly available data sources, the district was and is prepared to analyze those sources of data. Some of the self-reported data include the PAYS survey, MAP testing, behavioral referrals through SWIS, which stands for a school-wide information system, which is part of our PBIS, our positive behavior interventions and support systems. Progress monitoring data and the identification rates that I just recently shared. Additionally, we have external sources of data such as PVAS scores and the results of cyclical monitoring. Those things combined helped to create sort of a landscape whereby some of our greatest needs were either illuminated or questioned. In this case, all of the external findings are an extension really of what our internal mechanisms were telling us. I'm going to return to that as well. So let's talk a little bit about this. Broadly speaking, our needs can be broken down into these same categories, internally and externally identified needs. So one, in part to mitigate the structural barriers that lead to inequitable outcomes, the district needs a more comprehensive model of pre-intervention supports. While the district needs to uphold its child find obligations, more work needs to be done in order to provide all students with the interventions required, leading up to the referral for an evaluation. Two, by expanding a continuum of services to include comprehensive pre-intervention or pre-referral supports, issues resulting in disproportionality will decrease over time. Rather than a system where identification is necessary in order to get services, moving towards a model whereby response to those services is actually necessary for an identification will result in increased equity without sacrificing the district's obligation to child find. Three, the district needs to rethink comprehensive parent training. Feedback from the community has shed light on the desire for a more collaborative and official partnership. This includes regularly scheduled meetings between administration and parents of students with disabilities outside of IEP teams in order to focus on mutual professional development and updates on initiatives in an effort to supplement the current parent engagement opportunities that already exist for families. The need for parent training is less about quote unquote training than about forging a new direction for a relationship between the district and the district administration, and parents concerning matters of special education. One such partnership that the district is currently in discussions with is the Neurodiverse Education Advocacy Team at WSSD, or NEET. We're going to kind of come back to that. I know we have folks here today representing that organization. As I said on the last slide, external mechanisms validated much of our internal data. Our cyclical monitoring confirmed that graduation rates among students with disabilities remains a priority. It's noteworthy, by the way, that the state, I'm just going to throw this out there, does miscount our graduation dates. And I'm going to give you an example. For students who participate in life skills, we would be hard pressed to graduate them prior to the age of 21. The state counts any student who doesn't graduate in a four-year cohort as a dropout. The state is aware of that. It is counted against us just the same. Our solution to that is by no means to exit students prematurely. But I just want to throw that out there that in some ways, some of these data points have to be qualified. The district should ensure that all students are being educated in the least restrictive environment possible, as is required by the law. The more the district is able to offer a comprehensive model of pre-intervention, the less it becomes required to pull students out in order to deliver special education services, let alone in an environment without any non-disabled peers. In essence, the special education classroom becomes reserved under this model for the very neediest students and is used sparingly and following the delivery of evidence-based interventions and data, thereby indicating that it's required. Finally, the district was asked to ensure that as many students participate in state testing as possible. This is from the audit. As the district continues to onboard new administrators, we should take another look at PSSA and PASA data as part of a broad patchwork. Data-informed decision-making is the only way forward, and it needs to be done as a partnership between general education, special education, teachers, related service providers, and quite frankly, the community. So I think there is a lesson, the audit kind of citing this idea of participation in PSSAs. It wasn't scores, it was just participation in PSSAs and PASA. And I think the lesson to be learned there is those are vital data points and the district has room to grow in terms of relying on data to make decisions. Okay, as always, the district has challenges that need to be considered. There's an absence, quite frankly, if you were at last night's legislative meeting, you may have heard a little bit about our budget and where we are at with that. There is an absence of a commercial base in this district. That's a fact. Special education is notoriously costly, which further underscores the importance of using it in a highly targeted fashion. The district needs to use its facilities in a targeted fashion as well. We already have quote unquote hub programs whereby students of low incidence disabilities attend school at an elementary building that may not be their neighborhood school. And we do this to capitalize on resources where the infrastructure in those schools is already intact. So rather than have three students and one teacher in each of the three buildings, we can have nine students and two teachers in one building and really keep all of our related service folks in that one elementary building. That is about resources and just priorities. So efforts to streamline staff so that WSSD also other efforts include streamlining staff so that WSSD has greater oversight of more of its professionals. This is critical. It's already underway. The district's going to move, for instance, towards a speech and language department next year that is 100% WSSD employees. It's working to identify services that require third party contractors only because those services are so seldom provided or so hyper-specialized that they are necessary. The district has little choice then but to subcontract in those areas. But in all other areas where opportunities exist to bring more employees into the fold as district employees, where we can have greater oversight and uniform standards, we aim to do so. In In feedback sessions, we ask staff as well as parents these two thematic questions. This is the first. How can the district better support all students so that providing supports is less dependent on special education identification? Just think about that for a second. And second, how might the district promote neurodiversity so that it is viewed more as fundamentally important to the community and less as a subset of the community? These questions and the answers we received so far, again, offered us an opportunity to weigh the new data against what we already knew from the data we had. Taken as a whole, we know that we need a greater system of support for all students. As such, we require comprehensive professional development and coaching on the most cutting-edge instructional practices, particularly for hard-to-reach learners. The district is invested in expanding capacity for delivery of evidence-based interventions, regardless of whether those interventions take place inside a special education classroom or not. This includes delivery of Wilson reading systems and other multi-sensory structured reading programs with fidelity at all levels, explicit social skills and pragmatic language programs to students with autism, and expanded delivery of instruction of activities of daily life for some of our most impacted learners, particularly as they transition to post-secondary life. Again, a data-rich model whereby we assess early and often allows us to intervene in a timely and meaningful fashion. And it starts in general education. By embedding more effective supports within the general education curriculum, we will be more poised to tackle struggling learners without having to pull them for support in an isolated setting. Along the lines of establishing a meaningful relationship with parent groups, the importance of communication in general cannot be overstated. The district's currently amid a communications audit. Specific to special education, we need to have more systems in place whereby all stakeholders are empowered to create a more inclusive model that we're all searching for. So I mentioned, you know, we are in contact right now. We're consulting with one parent group who I know members are here tonight, but NEET, we look forward to using that partnership in an authentic fashion so that we can better communicate with, and I can go off a little bit on a tangent. It was not my intention to record this meeting until members of that organization brought it to my attention that was not a convenient time of the day to have a meeting. I think because of just that nascent relationship that is just budding right now, we were able to arrive at maybe an imperfect solution by recording this, but also talk through the issue. And if need be, we will have follow-up sessions so that we can get the message out and make sure to take feedback seriously and often. So in summary, the Office of Student Services aims through this plan to improve communications, expand professional development in terms of evidence-based interventions for all staff, align our practices so that they reflect a unified WSSD brand, rethink inclusion to expand more meaningful access to all students in the least restrictive environment, and cultivate relationships with a myriad of stakeholders. In the next month, you will see on our website that the Office of Student Services is going to post the plan using the template that's provided to us by PDE. Then it enjoys a month-long period for comment and review. So that is the end of my presentation. I would very much like to open it up and see if anyone has questions for any of the administration here. But yeah, that is it. Mrs. Rachel.
The plan itself will be available for students in the month, and then it's due on July 1, so we'll get it on.
At the end of June, at the beginning of June, July? It is on, prior to submission, it is on the website for 1 month for a review. So it's prior to submission. It's on the website, is not in a submitted state. It has a period of 30 days where it has to be viewed.
Can you guys let us know as soon as you post it?
Absolutely.
A lot of members here today really want to see the plan. I mean, they love the,
sure.
This is how you
yeah.
keep rolling up our sleeves. Right,
yeah.
But the wanting to see the words on paper and the transition plan.
Sure. Sure. So the PDE template, I would say, is probably not nearly as user-friendly as the presentation that was just given, but I will, like, there are parts of it where we're measuring classrooms because they're it's an assurance. We provide assurances to the state that we have not moved special education classrooms out of the ebb and flow of kind of normal building operations. So I'm operating under the assumption that you're not eager to see, like, is this room 12 by 18 foot? No. But I understand in the spirit of transparency that we will provide the answers to the questions such as, what is your model for disciplining students with disabilities? Oh, the district relies on positive behavior supports and interventions, right? Those kinds of things.
Yes, like the link that we met on April 29th, we had other plans that we're looking at.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. Yes. Oh, sorry. In the pink. I'm sorry. I don't know your name. You got it.
So you talked about this came from our audit, our diversity audit. Okay, good. Because I know it didn't. I know where it came from because I have the data. So going into this process, you knew the high percentage of Black students that are represented in our IDEA population, correct? Okay. What was the breakdown? How did you reach out to parents of Black students who fall into the IDEA? What percentage of parents were of Black students were involved in this planning process? What percentage were talked to? Because your comment about Black students was really disturbing on this slide. Your comment was something along the lines of, because I don't have a plan to write things down on, my apologies. your comment was that there are things that happen before school starts and interventions aren't done. So I want to be really clear, because I'm a data geek and I've looked at all the data, and I know in our district, what we are learning from our test scores is that it actually has to do with income. And I still haven't seen anything in our district that shows anything related to race and ethnicity and income. So what I see is that 14.2% of our IDEA students are Black. I also happen to know our disciplinary data and that our Black students who fall into the IDEA are more likely to have the police call on them and have severe disciplinary action. So, what percentage of the parents that you consulted for this plan are parents of Black students?
We did not go out of our way to break down who we contacted via race.
Okay, so I know that at the parent meetings, there weren't anybody, there wasn't anybody. Okay, and I'm looking around the room and I may be the only parent of a Black child who falls under the IDEA who are here. Now, I know that there's lore in our district that Black parents don't show up to meetings, but it would seem to me that if we have 14%, the highest percentage of our IDEA students who are Black, that you wouldn't even produce a plan, nor make the comment that you made, without talking to a significant number of Black parents. Because I need to tell you, like, at least from my perspective, and from the Black parents that I know whose kids fall into the IDEA, what you're saying about not having early intervention or problems before they get to school, like, that's not true, and that's racist.
I'm not sure if that's what you took from what I'm saying. I'm not making a connection between Black parents and not having resources.
So how are we understanding that the highest percentage of our kids under falling in the IDEA are Black, understanding that there's a significant relationship between Black students that fall into the IDEA in our district and disciplinary procedures, but you're creating this strategic plan without any parents of Black students? Like, that feels like a miss.
Okay, thank you.
So are we talking at all about how we are protecting our Black students who fall under the DEITEA?
I would invite you to come to discipline to policy committee tomorrow evening.
Yeah. I'm invited, I come.
Yeah, it's.
I wasn't invited to your meetings. I didn't know about them until after they happened, and I was told there were no other Black parents there or parents of Black students there. So any place I'm invited, please know, I'll come.
Yeah. Well, 7 p.m. tomorrow evening, we get to talk about all things discipline, and that is very much in alignment with what you're talking about.
But this is it's my job, like because I'm a parent of a Black student, to keep raising this flag, because I feel like we have had this data for years. We've never done anything about it, ever. And like it's exhausting. My kid's in middle school now. I've been having these conversations for 6 years, but still, we still have issues. And we're creating a plan without any Black parents or parents of Black kids involved. I don't understand how we're still doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Would you go to the slide talking about the extracurricular activities?
There
was one that said something about extracurricular activities.
I'm not.
It was one of the last slides.
Okay.
I think it was under the recommendation. So my two questions. One is pertaining to this. Including an extracurricular activities. Elaborate on that, and I don't know. I know most likely specifics are not going to go into the plan, but I'm thinking more along mentorship programs, and obviously Best Buddies is always on my mind because I think it's an amazing program for both the students who are in it and the students who are the buddies, not only while they're in school, but transitioning out of school and then later in life. I think it builds, especially in this post-COVID or pandemic COVID world that we're living in, I think it builds a lot of confidence in both the young adults and students who are the mentors, because they, I think everybody really needs a confidence boost at this point, but also it really brings those kids that need inclusion back into the fold. So maybe at some point, we can arrive at the terminology inclusion so that we live in this utopian society where it's just like we're all accepted as we are.
That is an excellent point. I will certainly, I don't want to put you on the spot, Sarah, but if you want to plug for yourself as being a fourth place, having a fourth place team in the state championships for Unified, go for it.
So I'm Sarah Holt. I am a teacher at the high school. I taught life skills at the high school for 8 years and then learning support for 2 years, and I'm going to be back in the life skills program next year. I'm also the Unified Boxy coach. Our team made it to states. We came in fourth place. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Unified Boxy, it is a unified sport. So that means students with and without disabilities are playing together on the same team, equal numbers, partners and athletes. And that's such a great opportunity for kids for inclusion and for kind of building those really meaningful relationships. Without it being sort of like they're saying, it's just this inclusion thing. These kids are competing together and they're really committed to this, and it's a PIAA sport that they're involved in. Part of what Special Olympics wants us to do also is to have a unified club within the high school. And so that is something that, it could be for some schools who already have the Best Buddies program. The Best Buddies program could satisfy that requirement. For other schools who started their own thing and called it something else, it could be called that. I think that we are going to stick to the name Unified Club for us, and that's something we're going to be implementing next year. It was something that Ms. Creighton and I wanted to implement right as COVID happened, and then she left and things kind of fell off. So next year we're going to be starting Unified Club, which is going to be very similar to a Best Buddies program, but not under that specific organization. So it will be an after-school club that will be an inclusive club for students with and without disabilities to meet together and in an inclusive environment.
Is there a reason that we're not looking at Best Buddies? Because they also assist with transition and like after school.
I don't know that there is, I think there is a lot of hurdles with that particular program. I mean, just like anytime you go through one sort of proprietary program, like we don't list the student will participate in best buddies per se. That being said, we do put things into an IEP that offer support so that a student can participate in, you know, football or what have you, some sort of thing like that. But I don't know that we have a reason that we're avoiding best buddies. I think it's just we haven't decided to commit to that particular organization.
So the unified hub concept, will that trickle down into all the schools, all the elementary and middle?
So right now, you know, I'm kind of bringing that to the high school.
Right.
I'm sure that there are opportunities for that to happen.
I think that's what Gina, because we have children.
Yeah.
Your first grade, so we don't
want to
wait until high school to take.
And I think that's an attempt. I think Karen, that's an attempt to mirror competitive sports that are also not offered in elementary, right?
Right.
So I think it's sort of an attempt to do that. In terms of, you know, opportunities for extracurricular activities at an elementary level, I think that is a really, you know, good conversation to have. How do we make those more accessible?
Well, particularly because of the elementary level, that's where the foundational social and emotional skills are, you know, that's the tree roots, right?
Yeah.
To everything else.
That's where kids learn.
I think disregard is something that, and that, you know, Dr. Savage gave a nice plug last, you know, of all the wonderful things he's doing.
Yes.
So there's a lot of good things there, and if they're not happy at the other school, maybe something similar can stand up. I think that's a ukulele partner playing. You know, so, you know, learning and reading buddies and muffin cart, some really good things, guys. So I think there's a lot of opportunity at the other schools.
I think it's also really important, rather than listing sort of, this, you know, we're going to use best buddies or we're going to have a ukulele partners thing, is to really be talking about the ways that we want to get student and parent voice to identify what are the areas of interest. Because, you know, Sarah and I, and Regina, have worked for years around trying to create what we called at the time Panther Pals, some other extracurricular sort of things. And what we learned, I would say the hard way, is that without student buy-in, it didn't amount to much. And so really, I would love for some of the focus to be on how do we elicit student voice, and for our younger folks, parent voice, about what are areas of interest, what are areas that we could connect kids to school. So I'd really like to see that in the plan rather than sort of spelled out. If, you know, the plan would not include spelled out proprietary programs, even if you were going to use one per se.
And I feel more optimistic about kind of trying this again because of the momentum from Bocce.
Yes.
I think that will kind of maybe help with this new plan.
And part of its success is because it did come from students.
Yeah,
and that's just the buy-in. I know you've had your hand up for so long.
Okay. I'm trying to go back to my elementary teaching days.
So
you were first, right?
The elementary level, I mean, to do something like a unified club is fine, but I would say, to me, looking back at my daughter, I think the elementary level has more opportunities just to have more organic social communication within everything they do throughout. There's just so much more opportunities with, you know, what the kids are doing during the day to bring them in rather than having to organize a specific club. So I just, you know, that's a great idea. But it's unified, for me, I think it's wonderful. For teachers as well as parents as well as kids to figure out how to get together. So this is like a big thing. I'm excited about that. I don't know how necessary going to the answer for the elementary level.
I think that's why I cited, right? That's why I think that's what I know, and I think that's more of a buddy's I'm sure it's amazing. Mm-hmm. I think that.
And that is a partnership for special one as well. There is kind of, you know, like a bigger thing behind it.
But I guess I was thinking best buddies too, because that is more organic, not necessarily.
necessarily you're in a certain club. It's wherever you are, you have this buddy. And I know kids from going to high school who actually are still friends with their best buddies and double date at the prom for best buddies. So it went beyond playing a sport or being in a club.
So I think, oops, sorry. I think you and then sir, I think in the back and that, or ma'am, I'm sorry, excuse me. And then ma'am, I think right in pink. I'm sorry, I did not catch your name. Okay. We're in that order.
Sister of a grown best buddy alumna. So I want to say this, it fits beautifully with your goal about valuing your neurodivergence because I'm actually really familiar with Special Olympics. My sister also did that as well. But Best Buddies is really special and really different. And she's in her 40s and still keeps up with her buddy. And but my sister was a little buddy, I guess, little buddy, big buddy, whatever it's from. And so it actually, here's the benefit of not homegrowing a program, because in my field, I do both. Best Buddies has lots of data. It's a model. People recognize it. Funders recognize it, so we're looking for ways to support our programming that we want to have. I want to sort of plug in for that. It also, they give you kind of all of the collateral, and it's research-based. So I know that we value research-based within our programs here. I know that Dr. Marseille really values research-based stuff. And it may not have been research-based when it started, but there is data now. So I just want to kind of throw that out there too. I'm all for homegrown, but Best Buddies is good because it's good. And it's not
really
great
barriers for the typical kids and the neurotypical kids, and they travel with them, right? Their buddies care for them through their lifelong journey of learning.
It's that beautiful goal that I love.
And then back so in the back. I apologize.
It's okay. I am gonna do a different subject. And
sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. It does sound amazing.
One more quick thing on Best Buddies.
Of course.
Both my children participate in the Best Buddies program that Villanova University has. So again, if you my name's Gail Zavilla, but my boys participate. They've now been associated with the National Best Buddies program for 2 years. And before that, they were kind of starting up their own program. So, and if you'd like to hear more about that,
Sorry, Erica. It sounds amazing. I'm going to go Google Best Buddies. I love it. I'm glad I heard it. But if this is a question that I think that you can elaborate on. It was interesting. I heard that one of your goals is to take contracted professionals and those that you have a lot of, bring them under the WSSB umbrella. That sounds like that's a clear goal of yours. You know that that's what the district wants to do. Can you speak more to that? What are your goals into who will be under the umbrella? What dates are you looking to have them all under the umbrella? Just more
sure.
data or information that you sure. have about that, because it's fascinating yeah. and it sounds really good.
Did you want to tag on before or after item?
I'll tag on now.
Okay.
So specifically, I'm interested in hearing about how the strategic plan is going to address counseling for the children. Kids who have, a complicated sort of profile like Mikey does in the sixth grade. And just a little bit of background, I've been reading about how basically mental health for the kids in our country has tanked. There's the pandemic, and that's made it more difficult. But I'm going back to 2009, 2019, CDC released numbers pretty recently about there being a 40% rise in depression for kids, and 57% rise in suicide rates for kids ages 10 to 24. So, that clearly speaks nationwide, and then bringing it back to the microcosm of our district, to need for expanded services just because of the sheer number of kids who are struggling. Um,
I know that in terms of my kid is in sixth grade, and two of the guidance counselors, the grade counselors, are going to be out for part of the fall for these. So we're going to have two substitutes in for a chunk of the year who don't have relationships built up with two huge bodies of children in these different grades. And then specifically, tagging on here, with the contract players being brought into the district, one of the tier two counselors. So my child started at no counseling and then tanked this year to the point where my child is not recognizable. They're not the kid I had a year ago, 3 years ago, and I have a GIPT as well, but that's not a year ago. So there's going to be this caseload of kids who are with the substitute counselors for a chunk of the year, but a specific tier two counselor who's contract player. The contract isn't being renewed. And she has a caseload of 20 to 25 kids. I think she works in high school as well. And I'll just name her, it's Kim Bean, and she is phenomenal. My older son was at the district, ended up being educated outside of the district, who has significant mental illness. I've been in the thick of it for years and years. I know the counselors, I know the psychologists, and the importance of a relationship of continuity for that trust to be built up. I know the budget for special ed got cut. So I am concerned about, for instance, Kim, how are we going to replace her, those 20 to 25 kids she serves? What's going to take place of that vacuum? Or specifically, is she somebody that we can bring into the umbrella? Because she is, I mean, Steve Kroll, Danielle Bertoni, Kim Bean, I cannot say good enough things about them. They have been wonderful partners to my child, to our family. Keep going back to before the school year even started, getting my anxious kid who is figuring out their identity in for a tour, looking at bathrooms, all of that. But for my kid, for the other kids, you get where I'm coming from.
Right.
It just has to be a crucial important part of the plan.
So the mental health. Go for it.
Lisa, first of all, thank you for saying that in front of this group of people. I think it is such a priority, and I think that it's sometimes hard for folks to be brave enough to talk about this. And yes, I know not you, but I just want to sort of publicly and for the recording praise you for bringing that forth. And thank you so much for singing the praises of the team that's been working with your son. So thank you so much. So just for a little bit of clarity on a couple of things, you mentioned strategic plan, which is more, more of a district. I just, for the audience, want to make sure we clarify, much more of a broad plan in general. This is very specific to special education and those identified with disabilities. So, however, there is now, and you talked about this crisis that has started many years ago and has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. There is certainly this crossover right now between, and you and I have worked that path pretty hard, right? In terms of special education and mental health and where they meet and where they part, right? So I don't want to say that it is not relevant to this discussion because it is. We were provided some extra counselors, some behavioral health counselors with ESSER dollars. And what that stands for, I neither remember nor do I think it's necessarily that important. However, as a result of COVID, we got some additional funding.
Yeah, and I appreciate you lobbying for that COVID funding for 2 years.
Yes.
And I know that was something that you did specifically.
Correct.
The vacuum that's going to be left behind now.
Correct.
My daughter's in the seventh grade, and it's the same thing. She also sees this name. And the therapeutic relationship they built is so solid. And then her guidance counselor, Vasanti, is also going to be on maternity leave in the fall. And so that's just.
So.
And those kids are hot messes.
We don't need that in a recording.
They know.
They know. Okay. So I want to just be clear that it's not that special ed funding has been cut. It's that the federal government provided money as a result of COVID. And in that time, we were able to get some additional behavioral health counseling. And you are right that those dollars are going away. But what we've done in the meantime, it's really important to understand, is that we have been broadening the tier one and tier two supports so that less students are needing a higher level of care, right? So we're able to provide supports in a less restrictive way that does not eliminate the need for every student on Kim's caseload. She will be replaced with a counselor that is a WSSD employee who was just bumped to the high school in order to fill a backlog there. But she will be returning to the position she was supposed to be in at the middle school. In terms of school counselors, people go out on leave and that happens. I will say this is part and parcel to why we have administrators stay with a grade. So because they take the lead on helping to connect people as they come in and out, that administrator remains the constant. And one of the things that's going to be important is to make sure that we're connecting people with community-based supports as well as these internal supports and kind of marrying the two, because we need to focus on all sorts of different ways to get support, whether that's at a more universal level, a more tier two level of supports, which we've never had at the middle school before. We're going to be moving to a formal tier two structure, or collaborating with outside folks to get people services in the community. So I don't know that that answers the contracted question that you raised, but it answers the specific question about a contracted provider that was here with COVID dollars. In terms of the contractors, I know the first sort of the first group that we've worked with was around speech and language pathologists. So we'll be moving those under the umbrella of WSSD.
When are those getting moved?
I think
those are as of 7/1. We should be.
But I do.
Yeah, I mean at last night's legislative meeting, one of the appointments was for a new speech language pathologist.
So, Pastor Eric, Sarah and I are probably both curious about the Wilson practitioner. Are you going to be bringing Wilson practitioners to employees?
Yeah, it's a totally different issue. We're sending people who we already have who are in the process of getting the full certification. So we're sort of we already have people in the pipeline. Yeah, I mean, it's getting your full Wilson's certification is essentially a master's degree, right? So it's not like we don't send somebody away for one day and they come back Wilson certified. But yeah, we have people in.
We have two identified individuals who already are working on establishing their hours for the fall. So we're halfway there.
And I was actually thinking about the speech therapist. My daughter is going to be using a speech therapist. The little kindergartner, she's crazy. But good luck to all of you. But okay, so the speech therapist thinks they're coming under the umbrella for this coming year.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's it's an example of going kind of back to the very beginning of the presentation where we're saying, okay, like, I don't know because I wasn't here, but large, influx of students who are eligible for speech may bump our numbers. And I imagine at some point we decided to cover these numbers because we thought it was a temporary fix by subcontracting. That's the benefit of subcontracting, is that you can, it's a temporary fix sometimes, right? Sure. And then when that need became longstanding, it is where we kind of looked at it this year and said, this is an absolute need to kind of streamline our services. We have 5 out of 7 people who are WSSD employees in a department. Why not take a look at this?
Right. No, that makes sense. Yeah. It's a plan for the future, right? Not what happened. So the plan is that you're bringing in the speech therapist under the umbrella. And I was just kind of asking if there were
sure. So I think
what the plan was for others.
Yeah.
Umbrella, if not done, just what the plan was.
I think right now, and I don't want to speak out of turn because I think the market in terms of human resources is not my wheelhouse. But there are certain positions such as a board certified behavior analyst where our office is looking at, you know, is that an area that we could streamline, not as a cost savings per se, but as a means for having just unified oversight. Like if we were, so currently we contract with different companies for behavioral interventions, but that is one area that we're kind of looking, taking a close look at. We haven't moved in with a proposal yet, but that's one area that we're looking at.
I want to get the person in the back who got their hand up so long ago.
I just wanted to bring up that something that I want to tell you to kind of like high school, like get the kids more involved in like elementary school or like middle of parents. And I have two extra kids in middle school, one in high school. I know like the things for the high school going on because honestly, my high schooler has fallen through the cracks. His teachers wouldn't even know he's autistic if it wasn't for me emailing him. I have never been contacted since, unless they have to know that he got the diagnosis. So nothing to move forward. And it kind of happened when we moved here first, right before the pandemic began. My daughter was in fourth grade, and she was put in a classroom, and her teacher didn't know she was autistic because that paperwork never went first. But I do feel there needs to be more communication with parents to know what is available for their children, because our kids can't always communicate what their needs are or what is going on. And so I just kind of wanted to interject that there when somebody said for the high school, the kids can't see it. No, the parents need to be involved. They need to know the things that are going on, things that are applicable for them, or just all those things. Because I can say with my 10th grader, 100% wouldn't even know where to start on asking for help because there's no resources for him since he's diagnosed, but he's there and it never went any further. So it's kind of wanted to put out there that we need to not just have a mindset that they're in high school, they can advocate for themselves, because I can tell you, even my middle schoolers can't necessarily advocate for themselves. Because my middle schooler came out of the school today and goes, I'm done with this year and I'm over it. I'm ready to be done. And I've never even called out the incident that happened at school. So there just needs to be a lot more work there on communication. You don't need to just say high schoolers, they can do it for themselves, and the younger kids that are the parents involved. It needs to really be across the board. Parents should still be involved, whether it's middle school, high school, elementary school. Because right now, I do not feel like I am part of the team with the school, with my kids. Because we're pretty much on the outside, and every once in a while we get invited. So there needs to be a lot of work there.
Point well taken, and I think that we would all agree, and that's why we did identify that as one of the needs and one of the recommendations is to find effective ways to communicate with families. To Dr. Sandberg's point, you know, Dr. Marseille, the superintendent, feels very strongly about that, and thus we're hiring a new director of communications, which I think will also lend some support in figuring out what is the best way to get messages out there. Because I find people saying like, well, I put it in an email or I put it, you know, on the website, but clearly, you know, information is being missed. And for someone who came in right before or during the pandemic, you know, that's a tough spot to be in. So your point is taken, and I think that definitely is a priority for us. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question, and it's a totally different topic. Dr. Sandberg, just in all of these slides, I don't think I saw reference to transition. I don't recall if I did or not, but I'm just wondering, is that a focus in the plan as well?
Certainly. I mean, I can, Regina, I don't want to put you on the spot. I can, you know, it is, I mean, it's a legally required part of every student's IEP once they're going to be 14 or older. I think, I don't know, I didn't actually hear the comment about advocacy. I'm going to kind of mix these two responses, which otherwise have nothing to do with one another. But I mean, I think we talk a lot about in this field, you know, explicit instruction for self-advocacy skills, particularly at the secondary level, because it's a legal requirement that we address those skills in any student's IEP when they're going to be 14 or older. Our transition coordinator here, who also happens to be the department chair for the high school special education department, can certainly talk a little bit about you know, what transition looks like normally, or
more in terms of in the plan. I didn't see that identified as an area for improvement.
Yeah.
I think there is room for improvement.
Yeah. I mean, not
I
think it speaks a little bit to the previous comment, which is it does relate actually to subcontracting. So we rely heavily on the Delaware County Intermediate Unit for a number of transition services. We're not looking to eradicate them, but I think we are looking to internalize wherever possible. Can we work on ADLs, right? So daily living skills inside our high school. So that is certainly a need that will be addressed. Regina, you can chime in anytime, but I know that is also a concern held by a couple of people here tonight. How do we, you know, generalize skills related to, you know, cooking, self-care, cleaning for students without having them go to alternative programs?
Yeah, and that's not how I view it at all. I mean, I'm thinking of it in terms of, frankly, I don't want my son learning at Cobra Fame in school. That's my job.
Okay.
So what I want is for us to have a conversation that makes sure that the educational content that he's receiving is setting him up for success at his high school, which is the textbook definition of transition planning.
Sure.
So I'm interested in the plan, and I'm not interested, like I say, I love him doing the cooking class, the actual form of class with all the other kids.
Yeah.
I don't want him doing a separate class.
Sure.
On anything, frankly. I don't
sort of transition more broadly from post-secondary outcomes.
So what I want to say, Mrs. Smalley, is that, I mean, every child has their own individualized transition plan. And I think that we try our hardest to make sure that we're hitting individual needs. So, you know, we can set up broad spectrum of, you know, services or, you know, this is how we do it. But doesn't meet our kids' needs. So we try to take very individualized students. What does this student need? What are their goals? What are their outcomes for after high school when they're 21? And honestly, what I try to do is work backwards. Where do you see your child at 21? And then we need to work a plan backwards to make sure that they get to where they want to be.
Right, and I totally agree with you. My point is just that, as you mentioned, that summary, that should start at 14. And we haven't yet done that really with my son, he's 16. I mean, it's just sort of a vague conversation. So my point is just, that's what I'm thinking and trying. I'm just saying there's room for improvement in terms of the planning so that all the years of high school are leveraged to maximize the output at the end.
So that's really good input. And there's a whole section in the special ed plan about transition. So just because it wasn't mentioned in any of the focus groups specifically and made it and didn't make its way to a slide, there is a large emphasis in the plan. So once it's posted, we would welcome feedback on the actual plan.
So,
I get it.
And Sarah and I, one last on transition. Sarah and I are also working this summer on writing a scope and sequence for low incidence students for transition. So we'll be doing research and kind of doing that. But like I said, it's not everything that's always like concrete, and it's like, you know, everything moves. And everything goes individually per student. So
Mr. Roberts, I haven't heard from you. I didn't know if you had a comment. That was.
So thank you. I really appreciate this work. And I think I was at a higher level question about where this plan fits in the larger planning of the school district. I think there's a lot of really wonderful aspirational pieces here. And you really close with some big themes, right? So thinking about inclusion, thinking about neurodiversity, thinking about where the setting is going to be for classwork. But I also heard you talking about the kind of segregation that happens because of resource consolidation. That doesn't sound like a school district plan that is trying to be inclusive or that supports the goals that you've articulated in this particular plan. And so I wonder to what extent this plan's success hinges on its ability to be incorporated into broader school district planning, and whether or not you have any comments about whether that would be the case, or whether that this would just be an exercise that is forced by the state on a regular basis. That again has wonderful practices built into it, and it built in some really wonderful larger themes, but can't succeed when there is not buy-in at a larger school district.
That's point well taken. And the order of steps typically supports that. So the student services will do a special ed plan the year prior to the comprehensive plan. And then that comprehensive plan gets turned into a strategic plan. So we're sort of that driving force that starts the process, which I've always really enjoyed. However, because of the pandemic, we are on a track. We are on a parallel track. So the curriculum office, general education, if you will, is completing their plan at the same time that we're completing our plan. So what it's going to take is just a little bit of an extra work to make sure that both plans are represented in the strategic plan. And the timing on this has been a little bit unfortunate. And the state actually sets it up in that way because of the way you said it. So it's going to take a little extra work on our part, but I think we're well aware how important our say in the comprehensive plan is and how that informs the strategic plan.
And just so you know, we've been letting you know on the NEEP Facebook page and the WSSB Facebook page, we do have a copy of the comprehensive plan that you can look at. And we have a copy of the Educational Affairs Committee plan that you can look at, and you should look at it because you can see a lot more detail in terms of some of the things they're talking about, assessments and the PBIS and everything that you would want to know and have questions about and should ask.
Thanks, okay? Kelly. Thank you.
Yeah,
for bringing that up.
So ESSER was renewed like 2022-23. Can I assume that we're gonna apply for mental health funding when it comes?
So apply does not mean that we will get it. And that is a question for, I can certainly loop back with our business office about. My understanding is that the money was received and could be used over a 2-year time, not that there would be two influxes of payments.
I think actually there is.
So
there's a new payment and mental health is one of them.
That's,
oh, it just happens to be my area of interest.
So that's a grant different than ESSER funds. The grant we have definitely applied for both of the mental health grants. Yes.
So Dina's a NEEP member and a grant writer.
Awesome.
So. I happen to get stuff funded in Philly, so I can send you what I have.
Yeah.
And certainly share with you whatever I have.
So, I think we've applied for both of the eligible grants, but if you think that there's one we maybe didn't, then send it our way.
I do happen to know. I don't know if you applied for it or not, but I will send it. Also, I just want to, I hope that we're hiring an internal BCBA. Maybe we will certainly prioritize hiring a person of color, particularly if someone who is Black, considering what we know about our population, right? Thank you.
Can I?
I was just going to say something about the change of Zoom part. I missed the first 10 minutes because I didn't have time, so I don't know if any of it has been covered then. But for transition, also, I think there needs to be a little bit more communication. I have an eighth grader going to high school next year. We had an IEP meeting. He was there for 1 minute because he was out sick. And we had that plan, and it was supposed to figure out what was supposed to happen for going to high school, what his needs were. It really wasn't addressed because middle school doesn't communicate very effectively, I'd say, with the high school. We're in this transition part of, I didn't even sign the IEP, and I don't think anybody knows this, because I asked for specific accommodations. And middle school's like, well, we're not going to put that IEP, that's not our job, that's the high school's job. But if you have a high school over here who has no idea that he's coming and that we want these certain accommodations for our class, and principal has told me, oh yeah, we can definitely make an accommodation. We did it by previous district I worked at. So we're kind of like, there's all these things that we brought together. There needs more communication between the schools going forth and putting those plans in place and even with IEP. It's just something I wanted to bring up because I've got a big brother who's going to high school next year, and I can tell you we're going to go into the year, and they wanted to know that he was in an independent gym class versus a regular. So more communication is definitely there also.
So I usually, as the department chair, I attend the eighth grade IEP meeting. And sometimes an IEP isn't due, and we'll just do an 8-9 transition meeting.
You weren't there. Instead, it was the head Andrea LaPera there.
Okay. So our assistant principal.
Yeah, and she basically said she had no food because the high school principal hadn't said anything to her about it. And then it went nowhere. So there was no help. And the IEP is still not signed.
Mrs. Taylor and I, my counterpart at the middle school, try to work really closely to transition those kids over. And her and I and the eighth grade teachers, we meet a lot. But if you have any specific concerns, you feel free to email me directly. And I like to respond to that. I don't like any ninth grader coming in not ready to hit the ground running. So please send me an email.
Okay. I think we heard from you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Please.
No, I wanted to, there was a little bit of mention about support and getting that more in the general ed. What about curriculum and looking at? I know one thing that we've experienced in transitioning to middle school, especially, is kind of the shock of kids who have IEPs not getting access to foreign language, as well as just things that are more, if we were looking at universal design for learning, things that were, you know, I've seen quizzes and tests were like, well, she has SDIs for this. Oh, but the curriculum committee approved this quiz, so we can't change it, even though she has an SDI. So has there been a look at curriculum to bring in universal design principles to benefit all students, but especially also our students with IEPs from a curriculum lens? What's kind of the conversation there?
The conversation is certainly always centered around special education. Can only sort of be as great as sort of the general education kind of dictates it. The more narrow the scope of general education, the more special education sort of has to get bigger, right? And sort of fix. That's not a knock on general education. I mean, I don't see them as different silos, but I think we are, particularly at the secondary level, see a lot of structural barriers of you know, that to your exact point, I couldn't even come up with a better example. I think those are perfect ones. I can go back to kind of a Wilson conversation at the elementary. You don't necessarily need to have an IEP to get Wilson instruction. It's not there's no law on the books that says in order to get Wilson. What's that?
It's not written in.
Yeah, it's not. There's no law that says Wilson instruction is only for pullout instruction for students with IEPs. And in many elementary settings, we pull students out and some of them are disabled. Some of them are not. Sometimes we might bring it into the classroom. But at the secondary level, you don't see that model typically. And there's a whole lot of reasons why, particularly there's an emphasis on rigor and credits, right? And that just exist at the high school in particular. And the middle school sort of looks at itself as a ramp to that experience. But I think your points are excellent. I don't have any great answers for you right now in terms of how they'll be solved, but I think there are discussions. We have a new secondary director of curriculum that's onboarding. We technically have a new, she was here, a new elementary director of curriculum as well. I think it's important that, you know, they're at the table for that conversation. So thank you.
Just real quick to follow up, sure. Are there actual curriculum pieces in this strategic or this plan or no?
It asks very general, the template provided by PD, I mean, and it will be up for 30 days, so you can see, it will ask pretty general questions like, you know, what continuum of services is offered, you know, which is offers kind of boilerplate language, I mean, in my opinion.
You shouldn't look at.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Real quick, the comprehensive plan, Ian, this is a question for you, kind of piggybacks off what you just said. It's as good as the general core educational, you know, curriculum. That's where we start. And I don't know if I see, there's no names of, like, there's no representation from special ed, you know, providing input into the comprehensive plan. Or is there, and you're not listed?
So because we're on parallel tracks, yes. We're sort of meeting together at the end of both processes.
At the end? I mean, the planning should begin in the beginning. And except, you know, and only because they're trying to, with the audit, they're trying to, you know, fix that. And everything they mentioned is targeting the three populations, the underprivileged, the Black and brown, and kids with IEP. So everything they're suggesting is about our kids, our audience, and yet we have no representation in the comprehensive plan.
Just because our name isn't on there doesn't mean that we're not large parts of these conversations.
There's so much discussion about assessments but there's a lot of talk about the assessment tools used, but not the actual program.
you know, so I think this is what this team wants to know. Sure.
One thing I would like to know, you mentioned what, make sure we have black representation across. Also, when we're talking about neurodiversity, making sure that if we're doing trainings like on autism, you should probably come to someone who's autistic. Making sure that we reach out to those individuals who are out there. There are advocates and trainers who are autistic out there, and they should be the ones speaking, and we should be pushing them forward. We tend to hear a lot of non-autistic people talking about being autistic when they're not autistic. And we need to be cognizant of that in our planning for training for teachers and parents as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the link comes out for the PDE.
Look, yeah, I believe it's towards the last week in June. We will put it on the website, and then that will be there for 30 days, if I'm not mistaken. And I will send you notice as soon as it's posted.
You put it out the last week in June, and it's due to the state July
1. No, it's end of July.
End of July. Okay.
And you're receiving feedback. What will you make changes, or you're just like taking feedback?
Yeah, I mean, we're absolutely. That's the purpose of the feedback window, is to consider revisions, make changes as needed.
And I think the comprehensive plan feedback is too, probably, so make sure you need us up to the email box.
A quick question about the pie graph, the pie chart and life skills. How is that determined? What influence do parents and their goals for their children have on how the child is allocated there, and the kind of has to do with what we were talking about curriculum, and part of the comprehensive plan talks about having these kids have access to higher levels of education. So how does the life skills designation affect access to higher level education? Yeah. Where parents?
Good question. And I think this is one of the more confusing kind of parts of sort of navigating special education, is that there is no such thing as an identification of life skills, right? So a student may be identified as having an intellectual disability. They may be identified as having a specific learning disability. In fact, about half of all of our students are identified as having specific learning disability as their primary disability category. Life skills is a program. Another example is, we have about 22% of our students are identified, so they meet the eligibility criteria under IDEA for other health impairment. There's no such thing as OHI support, right? So those students might be an emotional support program. They might be in a learning support program. They might be in a life skills program. So the tail end of your question was sort of
how do parents, what's their influence on that programming? Because we're talking about in the comprehensive plan, the thing we're just talking about is how our students are going to have access to a higher level of education. So do we as parents have influence on what the programming is going to be?
I would say parents at every IEP team are a very important part of that IEP process. It is intended to be as collaborative a process as possible. In terms of parents having influence over whether the name of the program, kind of like, is this going to be a life skills program? Am I catching that question correctly? Okay.
Yeah, because I see that's part of the comprehensive plan, is that these students, our students will have access to higher levels of education. So, you know, like, I know that they won't necessarily have a language. Will they have science? Will they continue when they get to high school, depending on what their programming is?
Sure. So I think, again, I would just say that parents, are an important voice at an IEP team. It's hard to say some sort of like a hard and fast rule for every case, I think. And I would also, just in terms of focusing on the names of the program, life skills, this is learning support, this is emotional support. Yeah. Please don't take this to mean that it doesn't matter what the name is. It does matter what the name is. But it doesn't compare to the substance of the IEP. What are the services being provided? Whether we call it a learning support program or an emotional support program, what matters is that the student has individualized mental health counseling, right, if they need it, right? Those are kind of the important questions.
Okay. I think my daughter's in the life skills program. And I think, you know, when we talk about kids needing access to the ABLs and the cooking and cleaning, I know some families are going, I wouldn't want my child to do that, but for, you know, that in the life skills program, ABLs and adaptive skills are a big reason why you would be in that program. So some kids need that, but not all kids in the life skills program are going to work on those ABLs. I think the reason why there's a big push for that to be included is because it's not present right now at the high school. And so there are kids with the life skills, but there's no opportunities in the building to work on your ADLs. And so parents like me that do want that piece, my daughter, they see she's transitioning to 21 and I want her to work on that. They haven't had the opportunity to work on that in due diligence, but not all kids. And there are plenty of parents that don't want their kids doing ADLs during the school day, and their program looks very different than my daughter. But
okay.
All those opportunities need to be available
right.
for kids that qualify for that program. And right now, that full range has not been available in the building.
That's, I think, what my question
is. So not only the parents that are going to be doing like washing clothes, doing that just because those facilities will exist, but there are people that do need that.
Thank you.
That is an important piece for many of the children that are in life skills, and that's something that many of the families want. And that is a piece that is part of life skills curriculum that hasn't been made available. So the district is making an effort to make that available so that the kids and the families that want those programs will have the opportunity to practice that.
I don't know what it's about, but kids not having access to lunches. Mm-hmm. And well, why that would be the case. I mean, they have to have access to everything. I know my son is in life skills and as on the life, and people with the same disability as him can speak up to 40 languages. I speak multiple languages. I think he'll probably end up speaking multiple. So I just
There is not, just to be clear, there is not a rule that because a student has an IEP or because they fall into a certain support category that they cannot take a foreign language. The obstacle that we have is one of scheduling. So when we are saying that a student has been identified as having a specific learning disability and they require individualized instruction in math and also writing and reading, those three pieces as required by law, we need to provide an pull out instruction perhaps that may come only during the time when that foreign language occurs. So there are scheduling barriers that we encounter all the time related to those sorts of things. But there's no rule that someone cannot take a language because of, right.
My question is about 120s, mm-hmm. and if they're now going to fall under what Erica was saying, and ask you about, you know, now as district employees, like this is it, my son has had a friend to know me aid. He had another aide at the start of this school year. She left in December with a week's notice and never said goodbye to him. And then ended up with a building aide from the middle school. So someone, we love her, she's phenomenal, but has no training in autism, no training in, you know, how to help him focus in the classroom. How does she get training
so,
to do that? Because, I mean, he's really struggling in his mainstream classes because, you know, she doesn't know how to help him.
Yeah.
In mainstream science class. He's failed every single science test this year. And I mean, we study with him. It's just a block where he has to sit at the computer and go through multiple choice questions. It's overwhelming to him. And we're just not getting the support beyond his learning support teacher. His case manager is phenomenal. But I mean, we saw the numbers of how many autistic kids we have at middle school. I mean, he can only do so much to help the other students. So yeah, I'm very concerned about training for the ones.
I mean, I think that is an excellent point. There, to be really clear too, there are no imminent plans to make it's, I wish it were that simple just to say every single subcontractor now become, there's a whole lot of contract language to kind of work through. It is sort of a slow process. It also isn't always the appropriate recourse. Sometimes it's actually very important to engage with contractors and districts do it all the time because again, the services are, I'll give you an example of we were to get an assessment done for orientation and mobility. Well, that may require such hyper expertise that a district, certainly not one of this size, is going to employ someone who can do that and have them on, you know, full time. So that is an example of where we might contract with someone to do that orientation and mobility assessment. Probably a bad example, actually. But that being said, we're not in a position where you know, you're going to find out that your son's 1-to-1 as of July 1 is a WSSD employee. Other than, you know, in the exact set of circumstances that you described, it sounded like they left and there was an opportunity to fill that vacancy with a WSSD employee, and that happened. But yeah, we are, yeah.
To a week before school, finding out from that aide that he was being pulled to the high school.
Yeah.
And we had no one to start the school year. Mm. No one met our child the first day of school. And that happened to a number of people in this district too. And just looking forward again, I mean, he would not be able to be in some of these regular classes without having
sure.
one support. And now we're just someone, again, she's a wonderful person, but has no idea how to actually help him in the classroom. And that's why, again, we're, you know, really, really struggling in these mainstream classes. And we're also told from the district that there are no other options for science and social studies. In the middle school, there's one science course and one social studies course for every grade, and that's it. And there needs to be more support.
Thank you.
Our Genovi aide has been, every year has had them moved and renewed in the middle of the year. They're not trained. They're not doing what they need to do. My kid is on her computer watching movies on YouTube. I don't really understand that happens with 101 aide. We don't know anything about it because we're not allowed to talk to the aide. So then we see like a trail of grades where she's not doing well. We say like, what's going on? Oh, well, I just watch YouTube. And I forget to. So, you know, like if my kid is a 101 aide, and I clear also that often they don't understand the IEP or they don't know the IEP or I don't know what's happening. But when you transition an aide just randomly in the middle of the year to the high school, which also happened to us as well, we are the contractor, we are paying Genovi, and there are certain things we can write into a contract because we are in fact the customer. And so I don't understand like why I've heard this story so many times. And why that happens and why the aides aren't trained, they don't understand the IEPs. And by the way, you can also write in to have him take his exams on paper. I just want you to know that.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we can probably read all this. Okay. So I think I have to thank you guys for holding the meeting and allowing us to come and hear about what influenced the making of the plan. You know, and then we'll look at the plan and
great.
It's a really great two-way dialogue. So I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah.
I just moved my meeting tomorrow night. I'll be here.
So all right. Here. Look forward to it. It's in B226. Sorry.
Okay. Okay. Bye.